So out driving around today, I was driving behind this lady who had a bunch of cat stickers all over the back of her car. I love cats, 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 cats. Spay and neuter your pets. One even said, dogs have owners, but cats have staff. I just felt like pulling up to this cat lady, just saying, I hate to break it to you, but you know, you got to buy a dog, but they give away cats. Oh yeah, and we're back, and we're here. Summer's shaping up. People had my blinker on during that intro. Sorry about it, Grandpa. So, what's going on, folks? What the hell's going on, people? Summer's happening fast. What's going on? I'm gonna tell you what's going on. The World Championships are starting this Friday. 10 fun-filled, glorious days in Eugene, Oregon, of all places. Getting pretty pumped up for that. And on the same day, the California State Fair is going to be kicking off. We got cover bands. I saw Huey Lewis one time at the Stanislaus County Fair, and I want to see something like that again. But what I'll probably end up seeing is like a Toby Keith cover band called Keith Toby, because it's it's two first names. What the fuck? It's like Bill. The beginning of August, just a few short weeks away, is Naked Man. What the fuck? Already? Jesus, has it been a year since I was embedded with the locals at the local nudist colony, just embedded into the community, just infiltrating myself into this gang of nuts, literally, just to see what the hell goes on over there. Crazy. And so that's the beginning of August. So I'm just pacing myself. But I was, I can't remember what inspired this. Last year, I'm always kind of fascinated by interesting people. And, for example, who is the most interesting man in the world? You know, is it, I found some phrases from that whole, like, the Dos Equis said with the most interesting, he's the most interesting man in the world. Well, I stole some of them, their phrases, right? And, let's see if I can find them. Like, this should be the defining characteristic of the most interesting man in the world, right? He lives vicariously through himself. He once had an awkward moment just to see how it feels. His beard alone has experienced more than a lesser man's entire body. His shirts never wrinkle. He's left-handed and right-handed. That's pretty good. If you were to mail a letter without postage, it would still get there. I mean, I guess that's interesting. The police often question him just because they find him interesting. His blood smells like cologne. On every continent in the world, there's a sandwich named after him. His hands feel like rich brown suede. Cuba imports cigars from him. Mosquitoes refuse to bite him purely out of respect. In museums, he is allowed to touch the art. His business card simply says, "I'll call you." He has won the Lifetime Achievement Award twice. If he were to punch you in the face, you would have to fight off the urge to thank him. I like this one particularly. He bowls overhand. He is fluent in all languages, including three that he only speaks. He tips an astonishing 100%. This one actually happened to me. Once while sailing around the world, he discovered a shortcut. Panhandlers give him money. He divorced his wife because he caught her littering. His passport requires no photograph. And finally, when he drives a new car off the lot, it increases in value. So who is the most interesting man in the world? I think it goes beyond, it's beyond like money and sports cars. I mean, sometimes those kind of liberally sprinkle the landscape, you know. But is it like Tom Cruise? Is he, you know, because everybody's painfully aware of this psycho, but, you know, he does his own stunts. He belongs to a cult. There's something kind of cool and mysterious about that. But until you find out it's Scientology. Is it something like in the, like Groundhog, like the movie Groundhog Day? I think the whole notion of Groundhog Day was to actually, if you break it down, if you kind of back engineer it, reverse engineer it, like Bill Murray is basically setting the game plan or the template for becoming the most interesting man in the world. I mean, it took him several February 2nds, multiple Groundhog Days to master the piano, learn French, save a man's life, befriend the locals, do a weather report. I mean, it's getting up there. That's kind of like the essence of that. Of, I don't know, in a compartmentalized way, that's probably kind of a simulation of what it would be to be the most interesting man in the world. I don't know. The jury's out. I don't know. What does it take? What are the key aspects? That's a great question. So let's delve in a little further, shall we? So who is the most interesting man in the world? That's a pretty subjective or objective question, I guess. It's a matter of opinion, for one. I mean, what's interesting to some is not necessarily to others, right? Is that the case? So, last year I did a podcast on Renaissance men and women, which kind of falls under that topic, right? You know, Renaissance man is somebody that kind of is well versed in several different fields, right? So, like template, I guess, even where they get the phrase Renaissance man, it comes probably from Leonardo da Vinci. I almost want to say Leonardo DiCaprio, but Leonardo da Vinci was like a astronomer and physicist and inventor and painter and writer and scholar and new. Probably several languages, which is kind of a criteria. Like, so in my podcast last year, as far as identifying Renaissance men, I think I boiled it down to a few categories. Like, you got to be able to speak more than one language, operate some sort of instrumented aircraft, I guess. I think it was, or play an instrument and or both. So, you know, fly a plane or a helicopter and play an instrument. And I think I ultimately crowned, of all people, Kris Kristofferson, probably the most Renaissance-y of the Renaissance men, of the modern Renaissance man, you know? Something of an, you know, the element of adventure is in there somewhere. But he was a helicopter pilot, which I think he joined the Air Force, if I remember right, and was trained to fly helicopters, and then went to work for an oil company out on the offshore drilling rigs as a helicopter pilot. But he was also a songwriter, played guitar. Could he speak another language? Probably. I don't know. But you know who was really interesting? It was Bill Burr, of all people, who speaks French. Fluent, conversationally. Plays the drums. I think his name was kind of kicked around. But then since subsequent to that particular podcast, I'd kind of come across, you know, a handful of other characters I felt were like kind of semi-worthy, or if not completely, but, you know, people that have been called at the most interesting man. Well, not a Renaissance man, but the most interesting man in the world. Like, I was watching, a Chef's Table episode with on Alex Atala, the Brazilian chef. And in the interview or in the episode, he was coined the most interesting man in the world by David Chang, which says a lot. You know, Alex Atala had that kind of that background. You know, he kind of grew up somewhat defiant, wayward, kind of fell into the punk scene, went to France to learn how to cook, or by accident became a great chef. But when he got back to Brazil and he opened up his restaurant, he became kind of in tune with local ingredients. So that would precipitate him heading into the rainforest, the Amazon. Big fan of the Amazon. He's a big fan of the waterways, conservation. So he spends a lot of time kind of outdoors. And so it just kind of adds like an air of mystery, or, you know, anybody that's kind of connected like that and has a vision that usually has a stake in it somehow. So it makes him very, you know, I don't know, to listen to the guy talk, you know, like in his interview, he talked about the first time he did acid or something of the nature, you know, like he'd taken acid. He was with somebody that he was trying to explain the meaning of life. And I think he was told that the meaning of life, if you just look at the way the flowers on a vine, how the flowers bloom and then they wilt, and as the vine grows longer, the more flowers crop up and bloom, and it's just a cycle. Like everything, it's a cycle, right? But there's also that element of that international mystery man. So last episode I was talking about, I think it was the last one, when we were up in Tahoe, and it just makes me think of the Iger Sanction. And why the Iger Sanction? It's a movie from 75 or something. And so I wanted to get a little background info, and I pulled up this, well, it was actually quite interesting little synopsis of the movie. There's a lot more going on in the movie than I
than I was aware of. Well, first of all, it was directed by Clint Eastwood, but what I didn't understand, or what I came to realize, was that the Iger Sanction was kind of an answer to, like, the James Bond phenomenon. So, and then there was also, you know, there was other attempts at kind of recreating or like subdividing the genre. Like, there was a couple of there was an American version of what was his name with Dean Martin, who played Matt Helm, who was kind of an American version of, it's kind of Americanized version of James Bond, Matt Helm, which I've seen briefly. I've watched bits and pieces of over the you know, when I was younger, but didn't have the same kind of pull. And then there's also Our Man Flint, which was a British version starring James Coburn, or maybe it was an Australian version. I think James Coburn's Australian. He's part of that group, you know, that gritty 70s group, you know, the Dirty Dozen group, the you know, one of the guys that was in all the, you know, those movies, The Great Escape, The Dirty Dozen, you know, Kelly's Heroes, Clint Eastwood, that group, you know, that hardcore group, John Cassavetes, Steve McQueen, you know, the guys that kind of came up through the ranks, right? Steve McQueen kind of grew up in a brothel. And he was a merchant marine, you know, stuff that nobody does that anymore. Nobody comes from those backgrounds, those gritty blue collar type backgrounds, right? And, but James Bond was kind of like the staple, I guess. He was kind of like the blueprint or the pattern or the model of that international man of mystery, that most interesting man in the world, you know. Kind of had a stake in all kinds of different disciplines. I guess probably has to be a master, you know, speaking several different languages, knowing, you know, about technologies, about espionage, about just great skier, you know. So Iger Sanction was optioned, they optioned this book, and it was by this anonymous writer who went by the name of Trevanian. It was just one name, you know, Trevanian, you know, like Cher or Prince or Madonna or like Vangelis, you know, the guy that wrote the Chariots of Fire theme, right? Dun, 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 dun. But the reason he did it in a pseudonym, and a single word pseudonym, is because he was a professor or some kind of academic, and he thought it was beneath him to write that kind. He did it for the money. He kind of, you know, we did it for the nookie. We did it for the nookie. So you can take your cookie. Shove it up your ass. No, he did it because he felt like the pulp novel was kind of beneath him. It was kind of lacked a kind of an academic scholarly foundation. It was kind of like it wasn't academic enough. It was just kind of, like I say, a pulpy kind of a dime store novel, right? But he wrote this book, The Iger Sanction, about this guy who was and I'd kind of forgotten about kind of like the whole kind of plot, subplot, but it's really enlightening. Anyway, this guy, his name is Jonathan Hemlock. So Clint Eastwood plays this guy, Jonathan Hemlock. It's a great name for an international man of mystery, right? Most interesting man. But what he is like, he's an academic. So Clint Eastwood, who in and of itself, I think, is one of the most interesting guys in the world. I mean, what is he, 90 years old now? He's still making movies, still directing movies, 90 years old. Like, fucking, you know, people worry about, you know, getting up for work and shit, and this motherfucker's still hitting it hard. You know he's hitting, you know, and you know he doesn't hold back. He is hardcore. He's old school, man. That's old school. So he plays this guy, Jonathan Hemlock. And just the name alone, the Iger Sanction, just sounds badass, right? But it's a total, it's kind of, it's borderline campy, It's kind of almost like they just threw everything in this movie. Everything but the kitchen sink, right? And even that was probably thrown in somewhere, right? So he plays Jonathan Hemlock. He's an academic professor. Good-looking 70s dude, well-built, you know? But he's got... But his thing is creating great works of art. He's a big art collector. So he does these jobs to pay for his art collection. These jobs are what they're called sanctions. You know, this is your sanction, where you're sanctioning this job for you. You have to go out and you have to infiltrate this, that, or the other. And in this case, it was he had to infiltrate a group of climbers. So it went and find out who was... who was like the double crosser, who was the, you know, simple story, black and white. But in the meantime, see, he has to like the job is, there's this kind of secret kind of society run by this albino who has to have blood transfusions twice a month. they call him the Red Dragon or something like that, or the Dragon, or just Drag, I don't know, some dragon. And it's in these kind of this dimly lit red light bulbed room with this albino guy who's kind of issuing the job, the sanction itself. And it's just so like it's like it's kind of an expose on kind of. I don't know. I'd always heard like John. I think was it John Ford? No. It was John Huston, the guy that directed African Queen with Humphrey Bogart and what's her name, Kate. What's her name? You know what I'm talking about, Katharine Hepburn. And but John Huston was like a big outdoorsy guy, kind of a big traveler guy. He wanted to travel on. The company's dime, on the studio's dime. So he would write these movies, or he would option these scripts that would take him to places where it would be interesting to go to, like the African Queen. You go to Africa, right? So he kind of did it, and I think you know, that could be said for a few directors that just kind of issue, you know, they option these scripts and they get all the studio money just to go exploring and go and have fun. And that may be what kind of, I don't know. Maybe Clint, that's what Clint was trying to do. So he became this, he's obviously really hands-on. He became like this dude, you know, wanted to be the man. And so he had all these elements of kind of espionage, kind of old school, kind of like just being a rugged, like being manly, being rugged, like... Like he in the beginning of the movie, what happened? He gets betrayed by who he thought was a stewardess, or back in the day she was a stewardess. Now she's a flight attendant, but it is a black girl played by what's her name? Vanetta. What's her last name? Grace. Very attractive, and. But she's a plant. She's a spy. So anyway, so old Clint talks her, chats her up on the plane, takes her back to his place. You know, they play Soak the Eggplant. And he wakes up the next morning. And, part of the deal he makes with the old Red Dragon, the old albino, is that he gets a letter from the IRS exonerating him from any wrongdoing for these works of art that are accumulated semi-suspiciously, and the next amount of dollars. Well, after he takes Jemima home, which is such a you can't call black women Jemima. Back in the 70s, that Clint, well, he didn't give a fuck. You know, he's old school libertarian. You know, he's just looking for something that kind of, I don't know. I'm sure it's not derogatory. Like Clint seems like a good dude. But he wakes up the next day after, after making the beast with two backs, and she's gone. The letter from the IRS is gone. The money's gone. So now he's kind of over a barrel. So now he's got to accept this Iger sanction. The Iger sanction is the job where he's got to meet up with they're different climbers from different, like it's a German climber, a French climber. They all play like the it's so like, they play real stereotypical representations of like Germans and French and, you know, but it's like, it's the culmination. It's like the ultimate kind of international man of mystery. So he's, but on the other side of the camera, because see, Clint is, he's actually doing these stunts. He's actually when I was talking about last week when they were filming in Arizona, I thought it was Arches National Park. It's actually Monument Valley. And, but he's actually, you know, he's doing the climbing. Like he's probably, it's probably one of the most realist representations of climbing since the movie Cliffhanger with, Sylvester Stallone, right? Which was actually based on a script that was written by a climber from the dirtbag days of Yosemite back in the 60s, 70s, the Camp 4 bunch, who were just a bunch of climbing bums. But what had happened was there was a plane crash that had actually crashed in a real remote part of the Yosemite Valley. And one of the climber's girlfriends worked in the radio dispatch portion of the state park. And she intercepted this call, and then she relayed the info to her boyfriend, who rallied all the dirtbag climbers that were kind of living outdoors, you know, cave style, out of their cars, Jimmy Chin style, out of their Subaru. And they wandered to this remote part of the Yosemite Valley and found all this weed. And it was, the plane had crashed. It was some kind of cartel plane. So there wasn't any real paper trail. There wasn't any kind of link to it. Nobody was owning up to it because it was full of illegal shit, right? So all the climbers, they just ransacked the shit. And it was, the funny part about it was all the weed, it was just bales and bales and bales and bales and bales and bales of weed soaked in like engine fuel, like aircraft engine fuel. And so when they would smoke it, like there'd be a little blast, like a little combustion, like little, you know, a little explosion to start off your hive. But they sold this shit. They sold it. Like they had a good, like that was a good summer. Like some people bought houses with this shit. But one guy wrote a script kind of loosely based on the whole event, you know, and ended up being reworked and reworked until it became Cliffhanger with Sylvester Stallone. So there you go. But the whole, the interesting part is just the whole interesting aspect of just being, in a situation like that, okay? And so a lot of stuff comes from like weird sources, right? But when it's put in the right hands, it takes on a life of its own, right? Anyway, the point of it being like the Iger sanction became kind of that. It kind of developed into this thing. It's kind of this answer to the whole James Bond. And I just kind of wondered, like, because James Bond was written by, who's the author? He was the guy that, what the fuck? What's his name? Who wrote the James Bond? I'm going to kick myself when I read this. James Bond. Ian Fleming, that's right, Ian Fleming. Well, Ian Fleming was the guy that is probably the most interesting man in the world, because Ian Fleming, he lived out in, he's a British writer. Well, here's the whole, okay, so the whole story is he's a British writer, journalist, and naval intelligence officer. Okay, so you already got the kind of the basic recipe for all, for, you know, interesting stuff, right? And it always has to do with spying, right? We want to be spies. We all secretly want to be spies, right? And because a spy has to kind of be well-versed in all kinds of stuff. So one of the, like, I was listening to a podcast, this guy, Lex Friedman, who's a, he's an artificial intelligence specialist and some kind of genius of sorts. And he was interviewing an ex-KGB spy. Really fascinating stuff. The ex-KGB spy, he started out as a professor. So it all comes full circle. So what happens is, they start out as probably academics of some sort. I'm just venturing a guess here as far as like an actual spy, like a spy. They have to be knowledgeable. There has to be a certain amount of knowledge involved. So this guy started as a, he was an academic and a teacher, a tenured professor, which I believe if I'm not mistaken, was he East German? He was a mix. He was like an East German mix with Polish and Czech. But in Eastern Europe, like tenured professorships are much less common than they are here. Like it's quite a prestigious thing. But he was kind of confronted by this guy who recruited him and then would ultimately just tell him like the whole procedure and how to become a, do you want to help your country? Do you want to make a difference? But we need to test you. And so the first thing they did was they sent him on a dry run. And what they did, what they would do is they would send him to, see, back, this was back in the 70s, back when the Berlin Wall was up. So there was actual literal boundary, a wall between East Germany and West Germany. Everything west of that was Western civilization as we know it. So it was really guarded and it was really foreign, but what they would do is they'd send him in on a dry run. Just go, you're going to go into West Germany, they're going to give you falsified documents, and you're going to go in, you're going to have a beer, you're going to have a bite to eat, you're going to stay there for 24 hours, you're going to act natural, then you're going to come back. Something basic, but I guess not everybody can handle that because they don't, you ever try to just act natural? I don't know. Sometimes it's hard, I guess. But this guy, Ian Fleming, he, best known for his spy novels about James Bond, he came from a wealthy family. And, well-educated, went to the universities of Munich and Geneva, moved through several jobs before he ended up writing. But while working for Britain's Naval Intelligence Division during the Second World War, Fleming was involved in planning like Operation Goldeneye. Oh, that's interesting. And in the planning and oversight of two intelligence units. So he drew from this wartime service and his career as a journalist for much of the background, detail, and depth of his James Bond novels. So, I think he lived, where did he live? I think he lived in I think that's the name of his compound too. But if I'm not mistaken, he lived in Jamaica. Let me see if I can verify that though. Where did he die? Maybe I'm wrong. No, I'm thinking of somebody else. I'm thinking of, what's his name? The guy that ran Island Records. Chris Blackwell. That's who I'm thinking of. Now, he is... Okay. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. Bah, bah, bah. Christopher Percy Gordon Blackwell. Still alive. Born in 1937. Who is the most interesting man in the world? He's an English businessman. Well, he founded Island Records. So, but he lives in Jamaica, man. But he's British. And former record producer and founder. One of the great independent labels. And probably the single person most responsible for turning the world onto reggae music. Like, he kind of created Bob Marley. Like, Bob Marley was Bob Marley, but he put Bob Marley out to the world, right? And super interesting guy. He formed Island Records in 1959 at age 22, was among the first to record the Jamaican popular music that eventually became known as ska, which has like a real... That's interesting too, because ska is kind of... seems to me it's kind of a blend of like a British semi-punk and reggae. Ska is like what... ska is like what No Doubt was early on. You know, ska. Well, you know what ska is. It's good shit. But returning to Britain in 1962, he sold records from the back of his car to the Jamaican community. So he went on to forge the careers of Bob Marley, Grace Jones, and U2. But yeah, he's one of those guys too. He's one of those real interesting characters. In 61, Blackwell was a location scout and production assistant for the Bond film Dr. No. So it's all kind of connected. Seems like it's all connected. But all the, you know, seems like there's a conglomeration of types that have, like, if you looked at a Venn diagram, and in the center of the Venn diagram was like, I guess it would have to be adventure, right? And then all the overlapping ovals that ultimately meet in the middle there of the Venn diagram, you would have probably education of some sort, international exposure of some sort, some kind of physically demanding background of some sort. Maybe you were a mountaineer, maybe you were a athlete, maybe you were a ball player, maybe you were a golfer, maybe an archer. Then you gotta have music in there. Like I say, it's kind of like the Da Vinci type situation going on there, you know? I guess it's not yet. Which you're just kind of not limiting yourself. I guess is the base, the real base inclination for all that. But it makes me wonder, like, what, you know, in a real world situation, what would James Bond have been? What background would he have come from? You know. because he seems to be proficient in just about everything. I mean, he can, he's a marksman. He seems to be speaking different languages. Great skier. He's always being chased on skis. You know, just a kind of depth of knowledge in various things. You know, if he's going to commandeer a powerboat, he already knows how to drive that boat. If he's escaping from somebody in Venice, Italy, and he just happens to jump into some canal boat, you know, they're just sitting there unmanned. It's always sitting there unmanned with the keys in it. He just hops in, just burns rubber, just rips out of there. But that's what happens, man. You're the most interesting man in the world. The keys are always in the ignition, right? But, for that matter, I mean, nowadays it's a little more, I don't know, as far as spying goes. Like, there's, they're right under your nose, right? Like, I used to work when I did cabinets. I used to, work out of this office in Livermore. And right next to kind of where the warehouse satellite office was, it was next to the Lawrence Livermore Labs. And it's one of the girls in worked in the office. Would talk about her dad worked at the labs, and she said, "Oh yeah, there's place crawling with Chinese spies." Yeah, and for the and I've actually delivered. What do I? I had to deliver something there. God, this was a few years ago. I can't remember what it was. Can't remember what the hell was I dropping off there, but I couldn't get in, and I don't really know what they even do with it. There's like it's like nuclear technology. Is it nuclear technology? It's some kind of heavy duty shit, right? Because even it spans a lot of territory, and there's a lot of back roads that I've driven through there, through the canyons and stuff. And then they've got some chain link fences that kind of cordon off the back acreage there. It's real dry, and across the other side of the, I think it's the, is it the 84, or is it part of the 84? Or is it just, I think it's just a back road. And, that you kind of weave through these like no cell signal canyons, and then there's like dirt bike tracks and stuff out there, real remote, but I guarantee you, like, when you get near that property, you're being surveilled, because there's some shit going on out there. So it's right under your nose, you know. Things also happen to be, well, nowadays it's like a lot of trolling, like a lot of Russian troll shit, you know? Not that we don't do it either. We've got our own IT counterintelligence department, IT spying. We got our troll farm. We got troll farms somewhere, probably in Lodi. I mean, why the hell else would anybody be there, right? But it's just, I don't know, that would be weird. That would be a weird, weird existence to be a spy. But not different, not too much different than what we kind of deal with today's. And, you know, it would be very, I think it would be a lot of neurotic behavior. And that's probably why, I don't know, the further we go into this crazy decade. You know, everybody seems to be wanting to be adventuresome now. Everybody wants to get on, you know, everybody wants to ride, be the first to ride a Segway across a Pan American Highway or, you know, some crazy bullshit, right? Although, but is that really, is that interesting? I don't know. I don't know, you tell me. I mean, what constitutes being the most interesting man in the world? Okay, so I finally I had to consult the expert panel here. So, first of two-part question, the first part. What constitutes to you, you personally and as a female, the most interesting man in the world? What does it take? What are the ingredients?
I mean, you're the best guy I've been with, but I don't...
No. Exclude, like, what's your criteria? What is your you know what I'm talking, because I've been talking a lot about...
Oh, a job?
Well, no, wait. Okay, let me preface it by saying, like, I've been talking a lot about, like, James Bond, Clint Eastwood, rugged international men of mystery, you know, that mm-hmm. type of, you know, the whole, you know, like that Dos Equis said, like, the most interesting man in the yeah. world, like, mosquitoes refuse to bite him out of respect, you know? So if you were, okay, so if you were to, like, if you had to, like, go out, like, in some kind of scavenger hunt and find the most interesting man in the world, what criteria would you use?
You follow what I'm saying?
Like, what are the checklists? Like, if you created a checklist, what would it...
Well, I was starting off with a job. That's the number one thing.
You keep the bar pretty low.
You can't be a loser. He's got to be funny, faithful.
No, I'm not talking about, like, okay, Cupid here. I'm not talking about swiping right, baby. I'm talking about the most interesting man in the world.
Okay, like, I think I do kind of like Clint Eastwood. I've always liked him. And then,
Okay, then what aspect? What about it? Because aside from the films, okay.
He's just always, his reaction to everything is always calm. And I really like that about him. Hmm.
Okay, what I mean, does he give off any kind of, is there a kind of a essence or a vibe or a...
Yeah, he's sexy.
But what constitutes that? What is it about?
He doesn't worry. Uh-huh.
So somebody that's just
calm and collected.
Okay, all right. All right, maybe an Indiana Jones could slide in there somewhere.
No, he does too much. But that one guy on that song that they, what was it? The guy that that I super liked. He was in Thelma and Louise.
Brad Pitt.
No, Brad Pitt's puke.
Harvey Keitel.
No, the dark-headed guy.
And Thelma and Louise.
Yeah. He also played in that movie where he's like pink and orange and blue. Remember they were all colors?
Oh. Yeah, that's Harvey Keitel.
That doesn't sound like his name.
Well, what role did he play in Thelma and Louise?
He was
the cop.
He was the guy that pulled out the ring for Susan Sarandon. And he goes, this is what I brought you. Remember? And he gave her like $5,000 and Brad Pitt stole it.
Oh my, okay, I gotta look this up now. Hold on. Because Harvey Keitel was in Thelma and Louise, and he was also in Reservoir Dogs.
That's not his name.
That's not Harvey Keitel's name? Harvey Keitel is not named Harvey Keitel?
No, not the guy that I like.
Okay, so... cast of Thelma and Louise.
Michael Madsen.
Oh, he was in Thelma and Louise too?
Yeah, he was Louise's boyfriend that wired her the
$5,000. I vaguely recall that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And he has the same attributes as Clint Eastwood. He's calm. He's just chill. He doesn't worry about anything.
Okay.
You know?
Okay, but you... Okay.
He doesn't work himself up with anything.
Okay. Well, what, for that matter, then, what about, like, Keith Carradine? Or Robert Carradine? Which, the one that was in Kung Fu? Who's in Kung Fu?
I don't know those people.
Kung Fu TV show? What was his name? One of the Carradines. Oh, God.
Is it the female one?
No. What is this? Have they just kind of run out of ideas? Is all they have is remakes to go off of? Kung Fu.
I don't like anybody that's last name's Carradine.
Did I say Carradine?
Is that what you said?
Carradine.
Oh, yeah, I don't like them.
You don't like him? You don't even know him?
Mm-hmm. He was the one in, with Uma Thurman, right?
Yes.
Ew, he's gross.
Yeah, he's Bill in Kill Bill. Kill Bill. Kill Bill.
There's nothing sexy about him.
But I think David Carradine, not, what did I say, Robert Carradine?
I don't know.
Or Keith Carradine? David? It's David Carradine. He was a badass back in the day on that show. I wasn't really into the show, but like, I'm talking about the most interesting man. Not the most sexiest man. Not the calmest man. Who's the most interesting? Interesting.
I don't know. I need like a whole day to think about that.
Okay. I'm starting the clock right now. You've got 23 hours and 55 seconds. 55 minutes, I mean. Okay, well, there you have it, folks. An inconclusive ending to a very complex question. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like powdered water, you know? What do you add, you know? It's one of those complex questions out there, like, like, yeah, it's very, it's beyond, it's beyond our expertise, I suppose. But I guess we can say Clint Eastwood's probably, he's up there. He's like 90 years old. How old is Clint Eastwood?
I heard today that Willie Nelson is 89.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I believe that. You know why?
Because he smokes weed.
That's right. That's right.
He was born in 1933, Willie Nelson was.
Yeah, he's old as fuck. He's the coolest. Dang. He's the coolest. He's got a pretty good story.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Clint East was 92. My God.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, Clint Eastwood. Well, you would have heard about that.
Yeah, I guess. Why does it say what's Clint Eastwood's real name? Is that not his real name?
I think those are like random Google questions that people ask. I think that's his real name. Yeah.
He was born in 1930?
Yeah, 1930.
My God.
Born in San Francisco. He's only won 4 Oscars? What? No, that can't be right. Jeez, he's been...
It said another 154 wins. What was that? Another 100 nominations.
Those are all triathlons.
No, they're not.
Let's see. Jump to director. You know, he's directed like a trillion movies, too.
Wow.
Like, he's like... Like, not only is he a, like, a badass in the... In, like... He's a huge jazz fan.
Really?
Yeah. And he did a whole movie... he directed a movie called Bird about Charlie Parker. Bird Parker, they call him Bird. Mm-hmm. Charlie Parker, he's one of the greatest jazz musicians to live. And so, yeah, he's a huge jazz fan. He's like, he's very political, obviously.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't really hold that against him. I don't know. I don't think there's a place for like arts and politics in the same. It's like, yeah, it's like the Who song, you know, "I Won't Get Fooled Again," is about, you know, idiot politicians and stuff. Like, there's no need for that. But my God, okay, so he's directed more movies, it looks like, than Steven Spielberg. As a director, he's done 45 films? Is that right? It says 45 credits. Holy shit. Is that right? That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Yeah, 45. He's directed 45 movies. That's more than like Spielberg.
Jeez.
And he's won the Best Picture more than once. I know he won it for Mystic River. I think he got the Best Pick. I think he won that one. He won it for Million Dollar Baby. I think he won that one. He won for Unforgiven. Like, he's a master director.
Yeah.
But you don't even think of him as a director.
Right.
That's what I find interesting. Like, those kind of people are interesting because there's so many skills. They have so many skills, and there's so much. They're adept at so many things you don't even suspect them being. Like, you don't think of him as a director.
Yeah.
He's just this... Well, you think of him as an actor, really. Or an entity unto himself, right? He's just Clint Eastwood, right? Mm-hmm. You don't go, the great director, you know, like you would Steven Spielberg or George Lucas or whatever. You don't go, the director Steven Spielberg. You don't go, the director Clint Eastwood. You go, it's Clint Eastwood.
The actor.
He's just Clint Eastwood, man. He's the coolest motherfucker ever. Well, there you have it. A woman's perspective on the most interesting man in the world. I think we all concur that, I guess, Clint Eastwood wins.
Today he does.
Today he's the winner. Winner. Coolest motherfucker ever. All right. Well, that's the end. That's the end, you dirty beggars. So I hope you enjoyed the show. And if you didn't, well, I don't know what to tell you. You need to go fuck yourselves. All right. I'll talk at you later. Arrivederci, babies.